This is Microphone Check, Hip Hop from NPR Music. I'm Franny Kelly.
I'm Ali Shaheed Muhammad.
I'm Bun B.
What up, Bun B?
What's going on, sir?
What's good?
Happy to be here, man. Thank y'all for having me.
Happy to have you here.
For real.
Thank you for fitting us into your schedule.
Oh, my God.
You got a lot going on.
Well, that usually happens for whether you're an artist or, you know, your album's releasing or, you know, whatever it is your field is. If you got to sell the product to the masses, you got to get out there and be about the business of selling.
Well, you got more going on than most.
Yeah, I feel a certain way when I'm not busy, you know.
Yeah.
I feel a certain way if I'm not actively pursuing something that can better my situation.
Okay.
So, like, if I'm sitting home for too long, I get very antsy, I get very anxious, and I get very irritable.
Mm-hmm.
So my wife is always like, you stay gone too much, you need to come home. And then when I'm home for a while, it's like, you need to get out of here. But it works, you know. And I've always been the person that kind of goes out, sees the world, and brings the information back. So I'm like Indiana Jones of my hood, you know what I'm saying? I go out and find the things that they probably would never see. Because I just try to open people's minds and enlighten people's minds. You know, I'm from a very small town, and most of the people that live where I'm from.
You can tell people where you're from.
Port Arthur, Texas. It's a small town about 90 miles outside of Houston. And it's a refinery town, so if you don't work at the refineries, you know, life is not the best life for you. And like I said, most of them never have the opportunity to leave that small town and go out into the world and see things. So I feel kind of obligated to go out and explore the world for their sake, you know.
When you were growing up, was that a dream, or was it just like you kind of thought that that would be your life?
I wasn't sure that music was going to be what I was going to do, but I did know that whatever it was that I wanted to do, I probably couldn't do it in that town. I mean, if I wanted to have, could I make a living in that town? Yeah. Would it be the kind of living that I wanted? No. So, you know, for me, I kind of had to go out into the world. And, you know, we actually had, the precedent was already set because Janis Joplin is also from my town.
Mm.
And when she tried to do her music at home, she wasn't received at all. Like, people really were against her because she was trying to do soul music, collaborating with black artists. And my town, the town I grew up in those days, was very racist. The outlying areas are still very racist. And she left and went out in the world and made her bones and came back as a legend, you know. So I was like, well, if I'm going to do it, that's probably how I'm going to have to do it. I'm going to have to leave here. You know, I can bring you back here, but I'm going to have to leave the city to make my bones, so to speak.
What were your influences?
Musically, being in Port Arthur, Texas, we didn't really have a connection with pop culture, per se. Like, outside of only two famous people. We had three famous people from where I'm from. And that's Janis Joplin, Bubba Smith, football player, and the, I can't remember his name right now. He's such a good person. But the Police Academy movies, the guy that was the bad guy.
Who was the bad guy?
The older sergeant dude. Because it was Steve Guttenberg was like the head guy, and then they had Tackleberry and all those, you know, the blonde chick with the big breasts. But then there was the sergeant that wouldn't let him do everything when they were trying to, whatever.
Yeah,
he was the bad guy in all those movies. But he was actually a classically trained actor, you know. So when he came to our school, and he actually spoke at my graduation, and I was like, wow, this dude is eloquent, you know, and he's very professional. It's like, I thought I knew who he was based on what he had played. And I was like, okay, if he can make it, she can make it, I can make it, you know. And even when I didn't really believe in myself, I believed in Pimp. I believed in Pimp C, my brother. And, you know, we just made it in our minds that we wanted to be something that this town couldn't make us, you know what I'm saying, at that time. The town had given us what we needed to become who we needed to become. We just couldn't become those people in that city. We had to leave and go out into the world.
So what were you listening to in high school?
Oh, wow. I graduated in 91. So my high school years are 88 through 91. So I listened to a lot of music that people don't even talk about nowadays. Big influences on me during my high school years were, of course, KRS-One. Boogie Down Productions was a very big influence on me, just in the fact that how he presented himself and his intellect and his ideals. I was really taken aback by how strong he was, how strong he felt, and how strong he held on to his convictions. That was a big thing for me. Three Times Dope was a very, EST was a very big influence on me. Ed OG, people like that guy. Def Jeff, you know, it was a cat that was a great producer, did some great songs as well. But I think in my high school years, out of all the MCs I listened to, the one that had the most impact on me was probably Brother J from X-Clan.
Straight from the Temple of Everlasting. Me, PXO, and the X-Clan. Chilling, cleaning the pinky. Hey, Brother J, time for a ride. Put the key to the ignition. And then...
Yes, Blue, I come on to gold. We're immortals through the portals, through the book fold. I'm going blackwards to the east, Tweedledee, Tweedledum. B5-Fum to the tribal drum-drum. I'm sitting on my temple, just plucking silly mortals. Speaking peace of mind to my many sons and daughters. Getting loose, loose, as I release the juice. I'm more into the ibis, cause a simple mother goose can never hang with the words that ever cause a clamor. I'm singing raise the flag, cause I hate the spangled banner. Because you can't get with me, you label me enemy. Your comments on the mortals.
The confidence in his delivery,
yeah,
the eloquence in his voice, and just that the passion for what he believed in. But I think the voice was key, because I couldn't really pin where he was from by listening to him speak, and I wanted to be that kind of person, because I didn't necessarily want my voice to box me out, because hip hop in the early late 80s, early 90s was still very regional. You know, and music from other regions was having a hard time because people didn't understand the culture of those cities. Like, unless you had been to New York City and you had friends that knew a 5 percenter, there was a lot of hip hop terminology that you didn't know, didn't understand. You had to kind of do your research. Same thing if you look at LA hip hop and you didn't understand the gang culture, then, you know, there were things that they were talking about, terminology that they used that you didn't understand. And the same thing happened with us, so...
I'm surprised that, you know, you're coming from a small town and you, like, I didn't expect, you know, you to, I mean, KRS is definitely like, you know, he made an impact, you know, but Ed OG, like, there are even certain part of New Yorkers that,
right,
that just don't, you know, no Ed OG or even Three Times Dope, you know, so to hear you mention Brother J, who I've known ever since we were 12 years old.
That's crazy.
Went to high school with him. shouts out to Brother J. But he definitely had a commanding voice.
Yeah.
And just, you know, everything that they presented, you know, was very strong and gave a sense of pride. So it's crazy to hear that.
No,
that influenced you.
Yeah, I didn't take the typical influences that most people did, because I never considered myself a typical person, and I always wanted to approach situations differently than everybody else was approaching them. So I looked for people like that in hip hop.
So were you looking for something that gave more of like a sense of pride and a sense of strength and, you know, political drive?
Well, yeah, that, and then also maturity. Hmm. You know what I'm saying? Because hip hop, for the most part, was very immature in its early years, you know, as far as being presented to the masses. But if you really looked inside the culture, the Chuck D's, the KRS-One's, the Brother J's, these were very educated people.
Yeah.
And whatever it was they were choosing to speak on, they knew their argument. So it wasn't just like they felt a certain way on Friday and made a song about it. They felt like they felt every day, and they stood tall on their convictions. Daddy O is another person. And all of these people, to me, the one thing that they all had in common was the voice, the confidence and the authority in the voice. So I figured if I commanded that, you know, it's not about changing your voice. It's about knowing how to use your voice, to me, vocally. And just stick to that, and everything else should work out.
Yeah, just so to be clear, you're not talking about just terminology or accent or diction or anything like that. You're really talking about your voice as an instrument.
Absolutely.
How do you, like, what do you do to your voice to your throat, to your body, to make your voice do what you want it to do?
I relax.
Okay.
Because I'm normally a very anxious person.
Uh-huh.
So for me, when I get in the booth, it's another level of comfort that I don't normally have in life. As far as business and family, I'm always trying to figure out, you know, what can I do to better the situation? What can I do to make things easier on myself and my family? And I'm always trying to, you know, moving a million miles an hour, trying to figure out the next thing that I can involve myself in. But when I'm recording and I'm in the booth, it's just in and of that moment, and I'm kind of locked into that moment, and it separates that moment from everything else that's happening. It's one of the few places where everything comes through very clear and concise, mm-hmm. and all I have to do is take my time and spit it out, and it works.
Do you choose beats based on if they will complement your voice or not?
I choose beats that would challenge me, as far as like, okay, this beat, you know, it's a little bit, the BPM is a little bit faster, so I'm probably going to rap faster, and so I got to make sure that even if I'm rapping faster and I'm using more words, that they're still clearly enunciated. Because I think the biggest problem that artists have is being misunderstood. Mm. You know, so for me, I don't want anyone to twist my words or to think that I'm saying something that I'm not. And then, again, hip-hop is regional, so some terminology people may not even know what that word or those words mean. But if you say it in a certain way, people will kind of get the gist of what you mean, even if they don't know the full definition.
Do you take care of your voice?
Yeah, I do now. I treated not just my voice, but my body terribly for years. I smoked cigarettes, drank a lot of hard liquor, and luckily my voice, I didn't lose my voice, but I got kind of close to losing, I guess, the force behind it. Like, I was starting to do a little damage to my stomach lining as well as my lung capacity. So I just had to, you know, kind of just back off a little bit and realize, like, look, if you were a quarterback, you wouldn't treat your throwing arm this way, you know, so don't treat your voice this way. And spending more time around, as I got older in my career, spending more time around singers, people who take their voices very, very seriously. They don't eat certain foods. They don't, you know, it's a whole process as to why. Like Michael Jackson, I think, is a great example. Like, you know, as bad as he may have treated his body, I don't think anyone treated their voice better than a Michael Jackson or a Mariah Carey. There are people who their whole life is based around making sure that no matter what else gets damaged, the voice is intact.
Do you remember the moment that you realized your voice was different?
I don't remember the exact moment. It would have been during, I did debate in school, so it would have been probably during that time. Whereas,
like that kind of debate where you have to talk real, real fast?
Absolutely.
Oh, and, man. That's a crazy word.
Yeah, and it's and I was the only one that got it, like don't, he always told me, like, don't talk fast because it takes away from your voice. Like, you have a strong voice. Take your time, make your arguments very clear, very concise, pronunciate your words carefully, and your voice and the authority on your voice will carry your words farther. Mm. And it's kind of worked. It's kind of worked for me outside of debate. It's worked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned just defining certain things, and I definitely wanted to ask you, for the people, some of the people who are listening, checking, microphone check, they're just now checking into hip-hop, you know, right. From the NPR side of things. So I actually had a couple of words that I wanted you to define for those people.
Oh, I'd love to.
Trill.
That's the hardest one. I'm glad we started there. Trill has always been more than a state of mind or a state of being, as opposed to just something that was easily definable. The people that I learned the word from never really gave a definition for it, but it was always just about how you carried. Being trill was how you carried yourself. It was about how you related to people. It was about how you moved amongst people. And most importantly, how you, I want to make sure I say it correctly. It's more about how you interact with people on a continuous basis. Like, being trill means that when, if I see you in 92 or if I see you in 2002, I'm talking to the same person. I steal, toast steel, give a fuck how you feel. We some southern OGs, real, recognize trill. All my hustlers keep quiet and my dealers don't slip. But it speaks for itself, so we ain't gotta say shit. I steal, toast steel, give a fuck how you feel. We some southern OGs, real, recognize trill. All my hustlers keep quiet and my dealers don't slip. But it speaks for itself, so we ain't gotta say shit. Mud B is the name, UGK is the P-A-T is the city, so if you hate, suck a dick. I'm from the land of the trill, from the home of the horn. When niggas don't wait to see you, they bring it to your yard. We ain't never been fraud, we ain't never been lame. So if you wanna get it cracking every
every nigga is game. Bitch, so we can catch a corner, or we can catch a square. Name the place and the time, I'll be waiting right there.
Being trill means that, you know, you stand on your, you have principles, you stand on them, you don't waver in your beliefs, and if people need you, they can always count on you. Not counting you as long as, there's no determining factors as to when I'm there for you. I'm always there for you. And that's kind of what Trill meant for us, because we were in a small town and we didn't really have an identity, you know, trying to craft an identity, being that close to Houston. You know, we like, why do we separate ourselves from Houston? How do we separate ourselves from these other towns around us? And being Trill and representing Trill was something that we had for us. And that was how we were able to kind of distinguish ourselves from everyone else.
Okay.
One quick follow-up.
Yeah.
Who are the people that brought that word into your life?
Trill came initially from the Texas penitentiaries. So it came from the penal system. A couple of guys came home from prison and just was, you were using the word, and you know, we were young guys looking up to them, and you know, we didn't know what Trill meant, but we wanted to be that. So we just kind of mirrored the way they carried themselves, and you know, gangster and a gentleman, so to speak.
Matter of survival, I suppose, depending on the environment that you're in, it's being consistent is important.
Absolutely.
To survival on all planes. Doesn't matter what world you're in.
Some environments, being able to change, being a chameleon works, and in some environments, just being that, you know, that one factor that everyone can kind of count on is another way. Yeah. And that's kind of been who I wanted to be, just somebody that, because a lot of the people that I, in my life and the people I've come across, you know, we have damaged backgrounds, you know, come from divorce and drugs and alcoholism and violence and all these different things, and, you know, very unstable backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you look for stability in people, in activities and whatnot, and I understand that. I've been through some of that. So I try to offer myself as a walking, talking bit of stability for people to kind of see how to carry yourself in case you don't know.
Is it because the culture, you know, of maybe where the word comes from maybe seemed like it's a street culture, a street, you know, way of life? Is it something for you that's defined by, like, coming from hustling and having to have a code of honors amongst the street, just amongst that community? Or for you, has it something that evolved into something that's greater and that's sort of may not encompass that, or maybe it does?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. I think, you know, it has its street credibility, which kind of entices people mm-hmm. into wanting to be a part of the whole Trill movement. But then as you really start to look and see how people who call themselves Trill really carry themselves, you realize that it's not just about keeping it Trill. Does not mean keeping it hood. Does not mean keeping it gangster, any of that. If you're a gangster, then always be that.
Right.
You know, if you're not a gangster, if you're, you know, square or whatever you want to call it, then always be that. And I can respect you for admitting that you're not a gangster and you're not about that life. I can respect that more than people who aren't but choose to propose themselves as being a gangster or hardcore. You know, I just, being Trill just means really just being true to who you are. You don't have to be a gangster to be Trill. So you could be Trill right now.
I am Trill right now.
See, that's what I'm talking about.
What I really appreciate about the way that you define that right there, that it wasn't masculine or feminine. It really was open.
Oh, no, it's definitely open to anyone at all who stays true to who they are. You don't have to be, like I said, you don't have to be a man or a woman to be Trill. Either one works. Your dog could be Trill, I guess, in that sense. But, you know, but you know, we might have went out on a limb on that one. But, but yeah, no, it's just really about knowing who you are, knowing what it is you want people to see you as, and staying true to that, regardless of whether it's the popular thing to do or not.
Right. And what does that do for, if more and more people live like that, what does that do for hip-hop culture, for rap music, and for, you know, society in general, those three being separate things?
Well, hip-hop has always been about, you know, braggadocio and that kind of thing, and there's always been room for exaggeration sometimes in entertainment. The problem becomes flat-out lying. in hip hop. And that's been a big problem of what's wrong with some of hip hop. And then the other side of that is that sometimes in popular culture, we relate too many things to hip hop culture just because they seem to be like, just because you're a rapper doesn't necessarily mean you embody the hip hop culture as a whole, as what hip hop was initially created to represent. You know, just because a person raps. And then like a lot of the bad things that we see from rap music gets attributed to hip hop because certain people don't understand the distinction between the two.
Right.
You know, rap is a part of hip hop, but it's not, but every rapper doesn't represent the hip hop culture. Every DJ does not represent the hip hop culture.
Mm-hmm.
Hip hop, most people think hip hop is music. They don't really understand that hip hop is a culture. It's a lifestyle. Mm-hmm. It's much more than just the songs you hear on the radio or on your favorite commercial or in a movie trailer. It's much more deeper than that. The principles behind the culture of hip hop are much more deeper than that. But we see these things and we see religion getting, you know, people twist religion to make it mean what they want it to mean. And we see that in hip hop as well.
All right. Another one of your words, draped up.
Draped up, initially draped up is your clothing and make sure that you're fresh. But then if you're, you know, if you're really into your car and you want your car to be fresh, so the same way you want your car to have new pair of shoes as the wheels, you know, everything that you would want yourself to stand out with, you want other elements of your life to stand out with. The house you live in, the car you drive, the man or woman you date. You want all these things to reflect you in the highest form, and that's what draped up is. My car is draped up. I mean, my car looks good. I'm draped up. I look good. My woman's draped up. She looks good. You come in my house is draped up. I got some nice furniture, a couple of pieces on the wall. My house is draped up.
We need to drape up this studio.
Big Mellow, Big Steve, Fun.
Well, it's Big Bud Beater, baby, Mr. Wood Grain. With diamonds up against them, balling through your hood, man. And I'm smoking on some good, man. The color purple. Not the movie, but the kind that have you going in a circle. Chrome looking more blasted in the Transco Tower. My car dripping candy paint like it just came out the shower. Like face, I got the money, the power, and the finesse. To roll around one deep with 100,000 around my neck. I'm looking real shiny, you can see me from a mile away.
It's one of my favorite words. Words from Texas. Throwed.
Throwed. Wow. Throwed is like I'm in my zone right now. You know what I'm saying? If you're drinking, you throwed, I mean you got a nice little buzz going. If you're smoking, you know what I'm saying, and you throwed, and again, you got a nice little buzz going. But even if you know you're at work and you know you brought that TP report in on time or whatever, and you know, man, I you know, it's supposed to be due Friday, I turned it in Thursday, man. I'm throwed with this. You can't see me in this PR game. I'm throwed with it. If you know you're good at something and you work hard to be good at it, and you know, there's nothing wrong with acknowledging it and you know being defined by it. I mean, like this is the throw show we're doing right now.
Good weed, good drink, big money.
Hey!
Rolling in something foreign, no leather gripping.
Yeah.
I handle my business, so I think I deserve the
chance. Hey!
Came in the dope. I said it before. I never fuck a hoe without head no more. I never pull up with nothing less than a foe. And I smoke cigars, it ain't just for the show. I'm blessed from the dope and known for my sit eye. I send a nigga baby mama home with a spit eye. You can have a bitch nigga, I ain't send him in eye. Smoke weed and freestyle, low instrument eye. Pin out, flip through the wicked streets of PA. Motherfuck the judge, prosecutor, and the DA. Head to the H where the hoes are fucked three way, two way, four way. Anyway, the pro say, never hear a hoe say, no, I won't. No, I can't stop it, and no, I don't. Cause a bitch know I might just explode and slap in the face with a pie element. Cause a nigga get thrown.
Good weed, good drink, big money.
Hey!
Rolling in something foreign, no leather gripping.
Yeah.
I handle my business, so I think I deserve to.
Hey!
No.
Hey!
No.
Yeah!
I know they hating on me, cause I'm the man. I'm too trill, homie. I don't give a damn. I'm a self-made trillionaire. I'm a self-made trillionaire. From the underground to the top, I came from
This one, I'm pretty sure people know, but I threw it in there. Self-Made.
Self-Made, which is, it's a term that's thrown around fairly loosely, because there's very few people that are actually just doing anything just by themselves. There's always somebody else that kind of comes in. But self-made means that, you know, there may have been other ways that you could have taken to get to where you were trying to go, but you may have either compromised yourself or put yourself in a position where you don't get credit maybe for what you're doing, and there's pride to be taken from that. Appalachian, but it's a rocky road, and I'm still moving up, and ain't no moving up, so keep it pushing, get to moving, bro. You might be new to me, but you know I ain't new to you. Go ask the white boy, they say he's totally tubular. Fucking bad bitches rub my dick against their uvula. Every time I hit the streets, it's like a fucking movie, bro. You know what I do to you, say Gladiator Studio. They gon' leave you chopped up like they was DJ Studio. Really just about establishing the pride that you have in the work that you've accomplished and in the way that you've accomplished that work. You know, you didn't take the easy route, you didn't have dad fund the project, you went out and got a real job and did it yourself. And again, it instills that kind of pride in you. It instills a work ethic and that I think is lacking in the world nowadays. It's very easy to let Google do the hard work for you nowadays.
Can you talk about some of the adversities that you've had to overcome in UGK's, maybe like label related or just like you spoke about just even having to overcome just where you're from, you know, to begin your art?
I think that initially that was the hardest part, was trying to figure out how to get on.
Yeah.
You know, there was no music scene. The music scene was Pimp C's bedroom. Mm-hmm. In Houston. So we realized that we were going to have to leave that city and go out and make our bones, and we did. And then it became an issue of education. You know, we knew exactly how to make music. We had no idea how to sell it and profit off of it. So other people who were, you know, more in the know of that kind of thing ended up making a lot more money than we did off of our music. We thought we were slick when we signed our deal. We hired an attorney that had previously worked for the label. So we thought she would have taken his inside information and used it to our advantage, but instead she ended up using it against us to the label's advantage. So that became an issue. As money came involved, the guy that started the independent label that we were signed with got carried away with the money, got a little frivolous, and stopped concentrating on the music industry. So we ended up leaving him, going with a guy who had ended up directing one of our videos that convinced us that we needed to leave our label and let him manage us. And I mean, he talked the good talk. He was an incredible conversationalist, and he sold a dream to us, you know, lock, stock, and barrel. And we ended up jumping out of the frying pan into the fire. This guy withheld, you know, all of our legal paperwork as well as tax paperwork. So we ended up in the red with the IRS by a lot, with no way to rectify it because he had all the receipts, all the paperwork. That was a ditch to dig out for sure.
Was this like beginning?
Or yeah, this is like... all of this is going on from 90. This is all between 92 and 95.
Wow. So this guys had hits out at this point.
Yeah. No, I had literally the number one record in the city and was delivering soul food dinners because we were making absolutely no money from the record company. And we hadn't yet learned how to start selling beats, you know, doing features. I started ghostwriting before we had, like I said, education ended up having to be the key. We had to really understand the business of music, which we didn't have any understanding. And we had always kept trying to pass it off to someone, that responsibility. So it wasn't until we took it upon ourselves to educate ourselves about the business that we really started to profit.
What steps did you take to educate yourself? And I ask that because there are people who be listening who may be in that same situation. They may not know which way to go.
Well, first thing you've got to do is be vocal about it. You've got to let people know that there's a problem. You can't solve a problem that no one knows you need help solving. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. Like, we literally went to the radio station, KBXX 97.9 The Box in Houston, Texas. Asked them, could we go on the air, and told the public we were broke. Our record company had us in a crazy contract. Management's had a crazy contract. So if they see us and we don't look a certain way, don't think it's a misuse of funds on our part. We're not getting it. Wow. So if you're paying the record company for this music, the money's not getting to us. Mm. So we made that a concern at first, and let people know that, you know, shit wasn't right. Excuse mm-hmm. my language. We just had to let people know that things weren't right. So, and then, you know, we started going to people whose opinions we respected and started asking them questions that for the longest time we had been trying to solve ourselves. So we went to people like James Prince, the founder of Rap-A-Lot Records, mm-hmm. people like Too Short, people like E-40, people like Scarface, who had been in the music industry and understood how things worked, and, you know, asking them very real questions about publishing. And I didn't know I needed a publicist for my first three albums.
Wow.
I didn't even understand that was something that I needed to help further my career. And it took a few years for the business, the education, and the talent to all catch up. That happened in, I want to say, I think it's 99, with the Riding Dirty out, my third album.
Wow. I'm coming down on the sled, boy. I'm riding dirty. Real though. I'm riding up.
Have you ever been rolling in a clean ass sack, blowing big out the window? Everybody got a sack. Got my heat right between my seat. Got a box of them things in case these fools start playing with me. You be surprised how them boppers wink. Girl, I can't stop. Give my headlights a blink and roll them up out the top. And keep moving and keep rolling. Fools that don't be holding, I'm coming through and falling. And I can't stand snitches, wanna kill all of y'all. Even though some busters fall, I'm still rolling like a ball. And having things my way, hitting that highway, selling that big, yeah, a flush ass place to stay. Police, they wanna run in, talking on cell phones, got a lot of kings done in. I wanna live like Arnold Willis and Mr. Drummond, and keep my paper sturdy, big birds and tight herb, fool, I'm riding dirty.
And then another thing was that we would get upset with the label and like curse Barry out, curse Jeff and those guys out. And then nobody answers the phone in New York for 6 months. Mm. And then I'm in Texas, so proximity is a problem. Because they'll tell me anything over the phone and then nothing happens because I'm not in their face. So then literally I got to get on a plane, fly to New York, scream and bitch about some things. Okay, we're going to do it. But then once I leave, again, it's about proximity. Out of sight, out of mind. So it took a long time to kind of work through that kind of a situation. Then we realized, you know what? You need proper representation in order to make this kind of thing happen in the way that you want it to happen. So, you know, it just, you know, and not giving up. You know, there were times where I did not want to be involved with the music industry at all anymore. And, you know, luckily Pimp was there to kind of pick me up, and then vice versa. There would be times where he would get, you know, just totally done with our situation. And I'm like, you know, we have to just keep moving forward, believing that once there's no more bad, there has to be all good.
True.
So it's just a matter of taking time and trying to, you know, work yourself through these situations, and, you know, hopefully everything comes out the way you want it to come out. In our case, we were blessed enough for it to come out the way we wanted it to come out, and the key to it was making good music.
What was some of the things that kept you going? Because I know, you know, for me, it's often just going on the road. Inside of America, definitely, but when you go to, like, the corner of the world, like you, like Budapest or something like that, that you just was like, why do you even know, you know, what we're doing,
right?
Or can relate, but they connect with the music so much. Like, what was it that kept you guys going?
I think for us, we were small town guys, and because of the fact we never had a lot of big videos, never had a lot of big media pushes. The only time people really saw us was in person, was like live on stage. Mm-hmm. Couldn't see us on TV, couldn't really see us in the magazines mm-hmm. or whatever. And we not only did Atlanta, like say if we do a show in Atlanta, then we're also going to do Birmingham, we're also going to do Montgomery, we're going to do Columbus, we're going to do Savannah, we're going to do all these other smaller markets as well. And because we know what it's like to be from these second tier, third tier markets that never get anyone. Like, being in Port Arthur, Texas, nobody ever came to my city, like, for concerts before you know, like we got out there and really kind of put our town on the map. And, you know, seeing that reciprocation of from small town to small town, kind of really understanding each other and supporting each other, that kind of helped a lot. You know, it made me like, okay, this isn't as bad as you think it is, because if you get out here and you really touch the people, you will see who you're relating to. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we had the best fans in the world. We had, you know, best supporters in the world, man. And these people, they live and breathe UGK. And they've always gone out of their way to let us know that they had love for us. And that, for me, that was key, because this game can be very cold. You can feel very distant and separated from everybody involved. You can go on a million radio stations, do interviews, and feel like you don't know these DJs at all. You can go to a million cities, do shows, and sometimes feel like you're not making that connection that you really want to make. If you're on this big stage that's 10 feet tall and the barricades have you 40 feet away from people, then there's, you know, there's this distance that you don't want. Like, I didn't want. I wanted to be as close to these people as possible, because I felt if they could look me in my eye and listen to me talk, they would feel me. It was just a matter of just getting in front of them. And like I said, with the best fans and supporters in the world, that when, you know, because there was always issues where with UGK and Jive, to where we only dropped albums maybe every 2.5-3 years. So, and I'm sure you understand.
Oh, yeah. No.
So we had to figure out, like, how do we still stay hot?
Right.
And the key is stay on the road. So we toured extensively, like, for, you know, probably the majority of our career was built on touring, because that was where people made their connection. I wish I'd have thought to sell a T-shirt back then. I'd be a rich man right now if I'd have thought to sell T-shirts back then. But
you're selling T-shirts now, I hope.
Yeah, I'm selling them now. 20 years later, I missed 19 years of that good merch money.
You know, you know what, though? But then there's a huge anniversary series, and I only say that because, I mean, like, you guys started around the same time we started. Yeah. So it's like, you know, we just come up on the 20-year. And I'm like, oh, never would have thought back then, but now, like, just actually had to make a decision on 20-year anniversary shirt. And I'm like, that's crazy.
20 years? Because so, you guys were November 8th, I think, for Midnight Marauders. And that was in 93. We dropped our first album on November 9th in 92. So, like, one day I literally did a post about Midnight Marauders on my Instagram.
Oh, really?
About it being the 20th anniversary. And then the next day I woke up and somebody was like, yo, it's your 21st
That's crazy.
Year anniversary.
That's crazy.
And that was the 21st year anniversary of my first album on the Sunday before my next album was going to drop. So it was literally my 20-year anniversary on Sunday, and then my new album was debuting on Monday. It just really just put this 25-year career in real perspective for me, because people talk, you know, we had the 20-year anniversary of the album last year, and that was cool. We did the 15-year anniversary of Super Tight and all these different things, and that's cool, but just, you know, to look at what you've done and then realize I'm still doing it. Like, if I never got to drop another album again, I got a crazy track record. I got an extensive discography that any artist would be proud of. But the fact that I'm still actually viable as an artist, and I still get to go out and do it now, and I'm still doing it at a high level, and it's appreciated, it just really kind of blew my mind.
It's true.
You know, look, I love it. I love it. That was told right there.
No, but there's, you know, I was thinking about that as, you know, we were talking about having you here, and it's just like, wow, you've, like, not a lot of people can say that they've been in the music business for 25 years consistently,
right,
and relevant, you know, and so that's a major accomplishment.
No, I'm a blessed individual, because very few people get to work anywhere for 20 years, much less doing what they love for 20 years and being appreciated at work for 20 years. I don't know how many people in this world that I've heard complain about having a thankless job. But they don't get celebrated when they go to work, you know? They go to work and it's just another day at work. I go to work and thousands of people stand up and cheer, you know? It's something to be desired, you know? But I respect the struggle, because it's all proportional. At the end of the day, you kind of get what you give out of it. And I've been very lucky that I wasn't lazy for the majority of my career, and I was never scared to give of myself, and now it's all coming back.
I just wanted to touch on like all the other things that you do in addition to the straight industry stuff. So you mentioned you're going to play with the Houston Symphony in a couple days.
That's Thursday.
I want you to sign my rap coloring book, please.
Without question. This is a beautiful thing. I have a rap coloring activity book. I partnered with a local writer. Well, he's locally based in Houston, but he writes for LA Times, New York Times, Village Voice, all of that. He's also a middle school science teacher and football coach. And we had talked about partnering and doing some different things over hip hop. But the first idea we came up with was very extensive and it takes a lot more research. But I also realized that this guy and I had the same kind of sense of humor. And I was like, we should be able to put together something really creative and fun for hip hop, because hip hop is always so stoic, you know? Mm. And, you know, we never let take our cool coat off. And I'm like, we need to be able to do something where we could take our cool coat off that everybody can agree is cool and fun, but doesn't compromise anybody as an artist or whatever their artistic integrity or street credibility may be. And Shay came up with the idea for a coloring book. And then he came up with an even more genius idea of adding activities like word searches, you know, mazes, color by number. And then I still teach at Rice University. I teach a course on religion and hip-hop culture in post-slavery America. Doing sports commentary now, working with Comcast Sports Network, potentially looking at a radio talk show. Again, I had one on AM radio last year, and I'm looking like maybe moving over to another radio station this year. So just trying to branch out and show people, man, don't box yourself in. Like,
what about You Gotta Eat This?
YouGottaEatThis.com. That's a food blog I started with my friend. He's actually out in the hallway, Premium Pete Givaldi. He's most notably known for SneakerTube.tv. He's a sneaker aficionado. But he and I have both have heavy and healthy appetites. And, and you know, we met over shoes, but we really bonded over food. And food to us is something that, you know, everybody dresses differently, wears different clothes, different shoes, does different things, but we all eat.
What's your favorite dish of all time?
My favorite dish of all time is what my mom would make for me. It's I guess British people will call it bangers and mash, but it's just sausage and mashed potatoes. She'll cut up sausages and fry them up real quick and then put it in mashed potatoes. And from I'm literally a meat and potatoes man, like in the most literal sense of the term. That's all I want to do is eat meat and potatoes. Maybe cheese, but that's
it. Hold up. Smoke some, bitch. My trademark, know what I'm talking about? Yeah, know what I'm talking about? Uncle Joy, we're talking about, hey, man. Do fries come with that shake? Hey, man, hey, man. Do green guys come with them thighs? Shit. Tommy Lou, so see.
All dickhead is money, dickhead and vapors. Don't chase the kid, chase the paper. Them thighs come with this shit. Bitch in your mind, ho, I got cake. All dickhead is money, dickhead and vapors. Don't chase the kid, chase the paper. Them thighs come with this shit. Bitch in your mind, ho, I got cake.
Man, you know I hit the first night, hit them right the first day. Look, but I got you gon' pop an old seafood, or you gon' have to eat food. Won't be in my foreign car, you gon' be a porn star.
How did that boozy verse come about?
That was something that we recorded initially for my last album, Trilogy. And we ended up not using that song. The beat leaked out and one of the verses leaked out, so I pulled the song off the album. And ever since then, I've just been thinking about what a waste it is to have this incredible little Boosie verse that nobody ever heard. And then when he went to prison, it became, to me, more adamant than people hear. But I didn't have any projects on the horizon at the time, so I just thought it was best to just leave that verse where it was for the time being. And when this situation with the album came up, it presented the perfect opportunity to include that song. But it was, you know, before he went in, I told him I needed him on a record, and he turned it around in no time, man. He's a great kid. I've known Boosie probably since he was about 12 years old.
Wow.
And now he's come a long way, and, you know, I wish him a safe return home, you know, in spite of the situation.
No doubt.
Cause them boys keep challenging me, so I'm gonna make sure I could drop them.
Drop
them. Load them up and cock
them.
Arms out the window and
I will pull it back. I will let it go. I will lay you down.
Boys keep challenging me,
but there's no competition.
No competition sounds very different from the rest of the album.
Yes, no competition is different. That's why initially didn't make the last album. Produced by DJ Khalil, incredible producer. Hook sung by Kobe, who Kobe Honeycutt is a great singer. And I wanted to put a great MC that I had a lot of admiration for on the record, and that was Raekwon. And
another guy with a voice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no doubt. Him and Ghostface, man, incredible voices, incredible strength behind it. And we've known each other for years, and the opportunity, I guess, never really presented itself until then. And then, but once we did it, it made all the sense in the world.
Until it good night itself, that's for the OG to do. And just between me and you, you know what we will do. Boom, I will pull it back. I will let it go. I will lay you down.
Boys keep challenging me.
But there's no competition.
So I'm gonna make sure I could drop it.
Drop
it. Load him up and pack
him. Drop him.
Arms out the window with aim.
One of my favorite sounds on this new album, I have to say it, is when I heard the little scratches. I was like, see what I'm saying? See, like, the, you know, you kept the element of hip-hop alive.
Yes.
On the album. And
Static Selecta, I think, did most of the scratches.
Could you just talk about that song and just the title of the song and just what it means to...
Well, there's two of them with scratches. There's The Best Is Back, the opening song, mm-hmm. where the hook is composed of scratches, mm-hmm. of different scratch edits. And that's something that a lot of early hip-hop used to have.
Stop playing.
There also was something that you had to give your DJ or your producer credit for knowing all of these different elements. I think in terms of that kind of hook, of course, DJ Premier is the best to ever do it. But that's because he has this incredible encyclopedic knowledge of hip-hop lyrics that knows so many different places where so many different MCs said that or said something to that. Static Selecta, of course, is a great student of DJ Premier as a DJ and a producer. So it's only right that he would have that same sensibility to bring in that element to a hook. And I saw him do it many times on his album. And even though he didn't produce that track, I was like, yo, I need you to scratch how you scratch. Bring that element to this song. He's like, what's the song called? Like, Stop Playing. So it took him like a day to go through hip hop and think of different elements where they said stop playing. He found enough of them, put them in the cook, and made it incredible.
Motherfucker, you saying you the man that's the kid in you. Because we knowing what you did and what you didn't do. It's not the shit you say, it's the shit you're not saying. You know better, show better, step it up and stop playing. Stop playing.
Niggas be lying, talking about they bust a heater. Once I see them, they be more like Justin Bieber. Leave it, my rivals underground like sky zoos. How I do.
I was just happy because you don't hear a lot of, like, you know, just a lot of artists from the South really, you know, like, encompass that element. That's another element of hip hop, and it just is a lost art form for some people. So hearing that, I was just all smiles.
Well, you know, hip hop, in the hip hop family, you know, the South is probably, you know, I look at it as being like four children of hip hop, you know, East Coast, West Coast, down South and Midwest. We're like the third born. So we're still kind of young in the game in that sense, you know, of still, you know, hip hop still for a lot of Southern people hasn't reached a nostalgia stage yet. You know, that's really just starting to happen with like a Pimp C and people having to really go back and look at the history of everything and kind of bring everything, you know, full circle and really look at the full career as opposed to present day. So now, like, we look back and remember DJ Screw, we look back and remember Pimp C, we look back and remember, you know, Hawk and Pat and all these great people, and it helps you put not just their career in perspective, but our culture regionally in perspective, and people get a much deeper understanding of what actually happened in the South in hip hop. It took a while, but now they get it. It's come full circle. They get it.
Thank you so much, Bun B. You have to come back because
I got to come back.
It's so much, you know, it's a history.
I feel like we just got started.
Yeah, we
on
just
this.
Got started.
We just, you know, just touched the surface of this thing. Anytime you guys want me to come back, the microphone check, man, I'd be more than happy.
You saying you the man that's the kid in you. Because we knowing what you did and what you didn't do. It's not the shit you say, it's the shit you're not saying. You know better, show better, step it up and stop playing.
Stop.
saying.